the puppy dog clothes. I'm sure that you've heard the story of the pet store owner who's trying to sell the little boy a puppy. When the boy says he can't decide, the owner suggests that he takes the puppy home for the weekend, telling him, if you don't like him, you can bring him back on Monday. He's sure that by Monday the little boy will have fallen in love with the puppy and won't dream of bringing him back. Back in the 1950s, my first sales job was in an appliance store where we sold thousands of televisions using the puppy dog clothes. In those days, television was new to most people, and you might be the only person on your block to have one. Your neighbors even expected you to invite them over to watch it and serve them tea and sandwiches. If we had a potential customer who couldn't decide, we would suggest that we would put it into their home for a trial. We knew the minute the neighbors saw the antenna being erected on the roof, they would be asking if they could come over to watch television. How could they not keep the television after the neighbors had been over to spend the evening watching it? At the real estate company that I ran, I would encourage the sales associates to carry an instant camera with them. When a buyer made an offer on a new home, we would take a picture of them standing in front of the house, knowing that they would show the picture to their friends and relatives. Then, if the owner wouldn't accept the buyer's offer, we knew that the buyer was much more likely to raise their offer. Who wants to tell their friends that they couldn't afford to pay more? The minor point clause. When you're selling, little decisions lead up to big decisions. If you can get your customer to agree on minor points, you are clarifying their thinking so that when you are ready for the major decision, he is less likely to feel pressured. The car salesperson asks, if you did go ahead, would you want leather or vinyl upholstery? Would you want the stick shift or the automatic? Would you prefer white or red? The real estate salesperson says, if you chose this home, which of these bedrooms would be the nursery for your new baby? How would you manage the furniture in the living room? Little decisions lead up to big decisions. The positive assumption clause. This may seem obvious to you, but it's essential to assume that the buyer is going to buy from you. It amazes me how many salespeople, particularly novices, make a negative assumption. They seem surprised if the buyer says yes. If you walked into a restaurant and the waitress came up and asked you if you wanted to order food, she would confuse you, wouldn't she? She knows what you're there for and simply assumes that you're going to buy food. You should do the same thing with your customers. Always assume that they're going to buy. I believe that fear of the customer not buying is at the heart of high-pressure selling, and it's why customers hate high pressure. There's no need to high-pressure a customer if you assume that they will buy. High-pressure tactics come only from salespeople who fear that the customer is not going to buy unless they force them to. So keep your conversation positive. Say, you like the looks of this model, don't you? Not, do you like the way it looks? Say, I'm going to include the extended service warranty because the small investment is really going to pay off for you, instead of, do you want the extended warranty? Always make positive assumptions that they're going to buy, that they're going to buy from you, that they're going to buy today, and that everything is going to go through without a hitch. The return serve clause. This clause teaches you that when the buyer asks you a question, there are times when you should reply with a question. Many years ago, I was buying a used copy machine from an attorney. I asked, would you take $200 for it? He said, are you offering me $200? I thought, how smart. If he'd have told me instead that he would take $200, I probably would have hummed and hawed around before offering him even less. When the buyer looks as though they're close to making a decision to buy and serve you a clarifying question, return the serve, and in doing so, you'll be getting a commitment. When the buyer says, does it come in black? Say, would you like it in black? Can you give me 45 days to pay? Should cause you to respond, would you like 45 days to pay? The prisoner of war clause. This clause is very effective with people who can't make up their mind. It requires you to relate a true and interesting fact to your buyers. I'm sure you're aware that during World War II, there were many stories of prisoners of war escaping from German prisoner of war camps. However, during the Korean War, there were very few attempts to escape. The reason was that the Chinese psychologically evaluated their prisoners for their decision-making abilities. They found that only 10% of them were comfortable making decisions, and these they kept in solitary confinement. They kept the other 90% in compounds where they were virtually unguarded, and yet none of them attempted to escape. As you explain to your buyer, the ability to make good decisions under pressure is rare, so they shouldn't feel bad that they're having trouble making a decision. At that point, they will decide that they are part of the 10% who do have the courage to make a decision and decide to go ahead. Or they may acknowledge that they are part of the 90% that does have trouble, in which case you explain that that's what you are there for. You're the expert, and they should let you make the decision for them. The alternate choice clause. When you ask people to choose between one of two alternatives, they will almost always pick one of the two. Very seldom will they select the third option, that neither of the two choices is acceptable. Frankly, whenever I use the alternate choice clause, its effectiveness surprises me all over again. Before customers have made a decision to buy, I will say, "If you did go ahead today, would you use your American Express card or your MasterCard?" They nearly always pick one of the two. Then I say, "Would you like me to fill out the form for you, or would you rather do it yourself?" With just a couple of quick alternate choice questions, I have closed the sale. The interesting thing is that even if they know what you're doing, people seem irresistibly drawn to picking one of the two alternatives. Be sure that both of the options are acceptable to you. Do you want it or not is not a smart alternate choice. This is such a well-known clause that you'll even hear little children using it. "Dad, would you like to take me to the video arcade tonight, or would tomorrow night be better for you?" As a grandson goes into the ice cream store, he says, "Grandpa, are we going to get doubles or singles today?" Use the alternate choice clause for setting appointments. Assume that they want to see you and ask, "Would Monday or Tuesday be better for you? Would 10 or 11 be better for you?" Be sure that you have narrowed the choices down to two. It won't work with three options, so you need to eliminate the third option. If you sell cars, you might say, "I think the first one we looked at would be too small for you, so it's between the red one and the white one. Which did you prefer?" If you're selling real estate and you've shown the buyer three properties, you might say, "I got the feeling that you didn't like the master bedroom in the first house, so if you were going to go ahead with one of the other two, which one would it be?" You can use the alternate choice clause to handle objections also. Perhaps you sell real estate and the buyer says, "We would never buy this house. Look at those awful green walls." So you respond with the alternate choice question. "So if you did go ahead, would you repaint the walls yourself, or would you have a painter do it?" Whichever choice he makes, you've won, haven't you? He can brag that he can do the job much cheaper and better than a painter, or he can tell you that he has better things to do with his time. It doesn't matter what he says, because either way you have eliminated the objection. The doorknob close. Like the final objection clause, the doorknob clause is dependent upon you being able to release the buyer from the pressure of the buying decision. When you've tried everything else and still don't have the order, you close your briefcase and say, "It was really nice talking with you, even though you decided not to go ahead. I can understand your feeling about that. Perhaps sometime in the future we can get together again." You appear to be leaving, but as your hand hits the doorknob on the way out of their office, you pause pensively and say, "Would you mind helping me? I always try to learn something whenever I fail to make a sale. Would you mind telling me what I did wrong? It will help me so much in the future." As long as they feel that you're no longer trying to sell them, they'll often be helpful enough to share with you why they didn't buy. They might say, "You came on too strong, too early. We felt pressured." Or they may say, "We liked what you were showing us, but we just can't afford it, and we didn't want to tell you that the payments would be a struggle for us." Now you can move to the Vince Lombardi second effort clause. Gently thank him for sharing and slide back into your presentation. Remember that the doorknob clause will only work if you're able to convince them that you're no longer trying to sell them. You're only asking for their help on how to improve your presentation. The divide and conquer clause. You may have to use the divide and conquer clause any time that you are trying to sell to two people. I've noticed that frequently opposites attract when it comes to assertiveness levels. A less assertive person will often marry a more assertive person. A business person who has a warm and easygoing personality, a people person, will often have a much more assertive business partner. They make a good team. The assertive, no-nonsense person admires the warm human qualities of the less assertive person. The easygoing person admires the discipline and firmness of the more assertive person. As I explain on side 12 of Secrets of Power Negotiating for Salespeople, an assertive person is a fast decision maker. They will take a look at a proposal and go for it or not go for it fairly quickly. A less assertive person agonizes over decisions, and analysis frequently leads to paralysis. When you're faced with this, you should use the divide and conquer clause. Get the more assertive person aside and say, Mrs. Jones, I really admire the analysis that your husband Roy is doing here. I wish I had that kind of detailed mind. But what concerns me, Mrs. Jones, is that you're just going to lose this opportunity if you don't decide to go ahead now. And you do want to do it, don't you? Then she'll go to her husband, who is still feeding the whole thing into his computer, and say, Roy, knock it off, for heaven's sake. It's a great opportunity, and we need to jump on it. Chances are that Roy will say, yes, dear, you handle it, and go back to his computer. Similarly, with business partners, you may have to find a way to get the more assertive one aside and say, I get the feeling that you're the decision maker around here, Bob. Let's move on it before it's too late. Chances are he'll say something like, don't worry about it, you have a deal. I just have to be diplomatic about the way I handle it with Harry. So whenever you're selling to two people and one of them is more assertive than the other, use the divide-and-conquer clause. Find a way to separate them and get the decision from the more assertive partner. The let-them-think clause. With some people, it's easy to tell when they're thinking. They use a pad of paper and fill it with numbers and options, or they pull out a calculator and punch in numbers furiously. With others, it's harder to tell when they're thinking because they just go quiet and work out the decision in their mind. That's a problem for salespeople because salespeople can't stand silence. They think it means that the customer has lost interest and needs to be stimulated with conversation. Sometimes you have to give them time to think. I remember when I was investing heavily in income-producing real estate, many times an agent would take me out to sell me an apartment building. In the car on the way back, I would need time to think it through. How much would it cost me to improve the property? How high could I raise the rents? Where would I generate the cash for the down payment? How would I handle the management? I prefer to do all this in my mind and verify my calculations later. To the agent, it must look as though I'm totally disinterested. All too often, the agent would interpret this as meaning that they had to give me more information to stimulate my interest. Nothing could be further from the truth. I simply needed some quiet time to think about it. Soon we would be back at the agent's office, and I couldn't give them a decision because I hadn't had time to think. So don't kill your sales by talking too much. As Samson would tell you, the jawbone of an ass is for killing Philistines, not for killing sales. The banknote close. If you sell investments, you'll get a kick out of the drama of the banknote close. You use it when your investor turns down an investment opportunity because he or she thinks that something better will come along. Take a $20 bill out of your pocket, drop it on the floor, and put your toe on it. Then say, let me ask you this. If you were walking along the sidewalk and saw a $20 bill laying there, would you pick it up? Of course you would. It's an opportunity that exists for you, just as the investment I showed you is an opportunity. You wouldn't pass up the opportunity to pick up the $20 bill because there may be a $50 bill laying further down the sidewalk, would you? But that's exactly what you're doing if you pass up an opportunity as good as the one I showed you today. The banknote close is a whimsical one, and the logic may not be impeccable, but the drama of the banknote on the floor will often give your investor the impetus it takes to make him say yes. The recall close. This is a close that I learned as a teenager selling televisions in England. I learned it by instinct because we didn't have much sales training in those days. I quickly figured out that it wasn't good to tell the customer everything you knew about the product. It was smart to leave something out that you could suddenly recall in case you're not able to close them. Perhaps I would demonstrate a television to them, and they would show interest in it, but tell me that they wanted to take a look in some other stores before they made up their mind. I would wish them the best of luck, and then just as they approached the door on the way out of the showroom, I would call out, "Just a minute, folks, I just recalled that I didn't show you something very important about this television. Did you know that the wood finish on the cabinet is completely resistant to cigarette burns? You can grind out a cigarette on it, and it won't damage it. Let me show you." Then I would lead them back to the television, demonstrate the feature, get back into my sales presentation, and go for the close again. Whenever I think of this, I remember the manufacturer's representative who first told us about this new miracle finish. All the salespeople in the showroom gathered around to watch his demonstration. He lit up a cigarette and with a great flourish ground it out on the wood top of the set. He was waiting for our eyes to light up in amazement, so he was watching us. We were watching the cigarette as it slowly melted the finish on the top of the set. With growing horror, he suddenly realized that he was demonstrating on one of the older models that didn't yet have the burn-resistant finish. I'm sure that even today, 30 years later, he still blushes when he thinks about that day. Whatever you sell, don't tell the customer all the benefits of ownership. Always leave something out for the recall clause. Perhaps you sell cars and you don't tell them about the special lock that enables the driver to unlock her door without unlocking the passenger door. Then you call them up and say, I can't believe this, but I just recalled that I didn't tell you something very important. I'd like to come by this evening and show it to you. Would 7 or 8 o'clock be better for you? You've heard of buyer's remorse, of course, but non-buyer's remorse is a reality, too. They may be sitting there thinking, I wish we'd brought that car home with us today. They still want to be sold because they feel guilty about spending that much money, so they may not be willing to call you. However, they welcome it when you call them and give them a second chance to invest. The take control clause. Some people have a terrible time making a decision. There are people out there who find decision-making so traumatic that they won't make a move until someone tells them to. In transactional analysis terms, these people are the child personalities. Eric Byrne took Freud's theory of superego, id, and ego and simplified it into parent, child, and adult. The superego, or parent, restrains the other two parts of the personality. The id, or child part of the personality, tends to act impulsively without thought. The ego, or adult part of the personality, reasons things through. You would think that the impulsive, childlike personality would be the easiest to sell to. After all, their philosophy is, if it feels good, do it. However, over the years, this has gotten them into trouble. So now they may really want your product and service, but they can't decide because they're afraid of the trouble they may get into. In other words, they have cold feet. These are the people who need to be told to buy. You tell them firmly, I'm not going to leave here today until I get your permission to go ahead. Everything tells me that this is the right decision for you. I can't leave here today in good conscience without getting your okay, so I'm going to make the decision for you. Just sign here, and I'll take care of the details. Of course, you can only do this if you're convinced that they should. Don't do it just to earn a commission. However, if you're totally convinced that they'd be making a mistake to say no, this extra push of decisiveness may be the only way you can get them to do the right thing. Now let me cover a couple of unethical closing tactics so that you can defend yourself when they're used on you. The deliberate mistake close. As with any con job, the deliberate mistake requires a victim who also lacks ethics. The buyer baits the hook when he or she prepares a proposal and deliberately leaves out one of the requirements or leaves the quality standards vague on one of the elements. Perhaps the element left out is the cost of stamping serial numbers, something the salesperson knows is required by law for recall purposes. The vague quality standard might be the requirement for copper tip switches. In either case, a knowledgeable salesperson will spot the mistake. An ethical salesperson would immediately point out the omission to the buyer. If the salesperson is unethical, however, he may go ahead and offer a low price that gets in the sale, knowing that he can come back later and raise the price to cover the additional items that the buyer will eventually need. However, the sting is on, as they say in the movies. Eager to close the sale before the buyer discovers the omission, the salesperson becomes a sloppy negotiator and may well make concessions that he wouldn't normally because he knows that he can make it up later when the omission is uncovered. However, as soon as they make the deal and the buyer and the salesperson are shaking hands, the buyer says, by the way, you realize that we're required to have serial numbers stamped on them and copper tip switches, don't you? That's standard in the industry. Hoisted by his own petard, the poor salesperson is too embarrassed to admit his deceit and goes along with the concessions. In reverse, the deliberate mistake is the car salesperson who runs an adding machine tape on the cost of the car, but only includes the price of a tape player when the car also has a CD player. If the customer takes the bait, he or she starts thinking that they now have an opportunity to put one over on the car salesperson. They become eager to close the deal before the salesperson spots the mistake. This eagerness makes the customer a sloppy negotiator, and he or she may end up paying more for the car than if he or she had pointed out the mistake. Apart from that, the salesperson still has the option of discovering the mistake before the buyer consummates the sale and, with an accusing look, shame the buyer into paying the extra amount. The counter gambit may sound high-minded, but it's obvious. Never try to get away with anything. If your greed doesn't cost you at the moment, it will certainly catch up with you later on down life's road. Instead, point out the mistake and say, I assume that you're not charging me for the CD player because you're trying to get me to make a decision now. The erroneous conclusion clause. A variation of the deliberate mistake is the erroneous conclusion clause. Using this method, the salesperson asks the buyer a question, but deliberately draws an erroneous conclusion. When the buyer corrects the salesperson, he or she finds that they have made a commitment to buy. For example, the car salesperson says, "If you did decide today, you wouldn't need to take delivery today, would you?" The buyer responds, "Well, of course we'd want to take it today." The real estate salesperson says, "You wouldn't want the sellers to include the refrigerator, would you?" The buyers hadn't been thinking of doing that, but the refrigerator looks better than theirs, so they reply, "Do you think they would include it?" The salesperson responds with, "Let's include it in our offer and see what happens." The boat salesperson says, "You wouldn't expect us to include a cover, would you?" The buyer sees an opportunity to get something for nothing and responds, "I sure would." The Dawson Pledge. You might call the Dawson Pledge the last resort. If everything else has failed, I want you to take the Dawson Pledge. You note the time on your watch and you mentally raise your left hand, put your right hand over your heart and think, "I hereby pledge that I will not leave these buyers until one more hour has gone by." Whatever it takes, and even if you never mention your product or service again, stay for one more hour. Ask for another cup of coffee. That'll take 5 minutes. Pretend it's too hot to drink and you can get 10 minutes out of it. Maybe the pot's empty. That's good. Make them brew another one. Now you're talking half an hour. Whatever it takes, don't leave for one more hour. Because as power negotiators know, the longer you can keep someone engaged, the more flexible they become. Just because they're telling you no now doesn't mean they won't be saying maybe 30 minutes from now and yes an hour from now. If all else fails, take the Dawson Pledge.